Go Loud. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Proudly sponsored by Johnstone Fine Foods. Buy premium Irish dry-aged beef at johnstonebeef.com.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Welcome to another episode of Dishing It Out with me, Gary O'Hanlon.
And me, Gareth Mullins.
And coming up on today's show, we'll have our usual recipe of the week, our culinary conundrums. And we have an artist in the house, one of your boys, Gaz.
Yeah,
Mazur.
Yeah, friend of mine, Mazur. Yeah. He's an incredible. I actually have a couple of pieces of his art at home. Do you know, I actually have one in work. I have one that hung in work for all my team to enjoy as well. But he's a really good guy. And
no, I said Master there with my big thick Donegal head on me. Is it Mazur?
Mazur, yeah. Al, his name is. So, really good guy. I know him from
Irish.
Yeah. Him and I train in the same gym. So that's how I know him. I know him for years. But he's really big in the. Well, I mean, he's going to tell us all about it. But in the men's mental health space, and he does a couple of He does a walk thing up around Wicklow for men to talk to each other. And he, I'm delighted we have an artist in, because I've always felt, and him and I have actually discussed this, our lives are kind of similar, I think, with the pull of creativity that we have in our lives for creating food. And his is obviously art, and I think musicians have the same type of thing,
yeah.
Or anybody that's in the world of arts, even though our jobs I don't think would be known as being in the world of arts, but as you and I both know, you can get writer's block, or
chefs are only as good as their ingredients, and an artist is only as good as his paints and colours, exactly. And whatever else is coming at them. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he's a really nice bloke, so I'm really looking forward to him coming in. So
am I, yeah. I don't know him at all, so yeah, sounds good. All right, so joining us now is an artist, the buddy of Gaz as well. We've already done our intro. Mazur, you're very welcome to Dishing It Out. Am I saying it? I think with my Donegal accent,
Mazur came out first.
And I was like, there's nothing worse than being rude and getting somebody's big northern twang and spouting it out wrong. It's great to meet you.
Yeah, I love to meet you too, man.
Yeah, so give us a wee bit of background then. What sort of art, or is it? I've never had an artist, never really. I don't know if I've actually spoken to a real life artist before. We're spoofers. We're spoofers as well.
Yeah, I think we'll be all right. I started off, I'd always had an interest in art as a young kid.
Be good at it in school, or not?
Okay. But I was sort of gravitated towards it, and yeah, I liked that. I think I liked that. I enjoyed art class and my art teachers and stuff like that. And then I got into graffiti and stuff like that, early teens. And that really sort of opened up a lot. That sort of
subculture. So see now, like, you're good at graffiti and doing whatever that ends up looking like.
Yeah.
Are you also able to correlate that into, say, image art or portrait art or whatever? Like, say you're at school. Like, I mean, are you just good at art in any way?
No, I would be very mediocre in terms of, like, the landscape of artists, I feel. But there was definitely a lot of, like, ambition and curiosity and interest. And that sort of brought my skill set up, you'd say. You know, so there was always that. And then with graffiti, yeah, there's the legal aspect of it. And then there's also the expressive part. And I gravitated towards more the expressive. And that I sort of mixed the art and graffiti and sort of created my own sort of...
But you really have your own style, right? Because, I mean, there's a lot of artists. I mean, whenever I see your work, I'm like, that's Al's work.
Yeah.
It's like instantly recognizable.
Yeah, that's your visual language.
Is that bad, love? If the Smokies are after you when you're younger and they're like, do they also get used to... Do they get to know who the black artist is?
I'm more talking about is art now rather than... I haven't seen a lot of your graffiti.
Oh, yeah, no, it's different. And you're jumping around styles and stuff like that. And that's all letter form based. It's writing your name and abstract typography, and you're skewing the letters to, you know, to stylize what you want to do. And there's a lot of art elements to that. But I sort of went in more the direction then of taking those elements of what I learned outside and bringing it into sort of gallery
settings. And Dublin as a city... Is it welcoming to graffiti art, or is it very much frowned upon? Because, like, you look at parts of New York or I lived in France for the last 5 years as well.
Yeah.
And I spent 6 years in Boston. Like, and you know, and there's parts where you're coming into Paris from different angles or whatever, and you just see this incredible graffiti here and there, everywhere.
Some might people might replace that word incredible for horrible or something. So it's very subjective.
Of course.
Know? And you know, it's a shared space. The landscape is shared. So everyone has an opinion on certain things. But like my sort of experience from traveling as well, and I would go for, let's say I'd be over in, you were talking about the States there, is over in like Cincinnati, and be over in Detroit, let's say, and I go for a jog early morning down the business district, and it's just grey, desolate, dead. And then you go into more cultural area where there's a lot of graffiti and street art, and there's markets and culture and vibrancy. So I think there's, for me, there's an association.
And there's probably lots of definite graffiti there then, where people like you are hired to actually come.
Yeah, we're brought over. And invited over, and to, you know, create.
Did you ever think your job would have you doing that type?
No, there was never any prospect of a job or anything like that. It was definitely just a side thing. And I always sort of went back to it. It sort of gave me a lot of focus and energy, and that community that it gave. I was definitely a bit more of an outsider, two left feet, so it wasn't really so this sort of, you know, like-minded,
found your people,
my tribe, let's say, the language.
And did you,
is now
did you do something else for work and money then before art started paying?
I was a kitchen porter. Well, very basic. One of my first jobs is just out in, do you remember the Doyle Montrose Hotel? Still Oregon.
I
was there just a lounge boy, and then I went into the kitchen after a few months and became a kitchen porter, doing that, washing dishes.
Tough
and then
game.
Instead of washing
pot, I was working in an oily hall.
Because I was on the one side of going in trying to ask the chefs for burgers, and they're all just pissed off at you. And then you go on the other side of it, and then I'm on their side because
you're
I'm
the man
supporting, and
chef
and
I was like, KPs.
You
know, chefs love KPs.
You just they did not fuck with you, and you had they had your back. And I think that was like in an early teens, I idolized these chefs, and I thought they're amazing. And then they asked me to do breakfast for all the Yanks in the morning. So we're getting up at about 5, going in there at 6, I'd say, early, easy. And doing, I remember the kitchens at the back, all the doors are open, so it's ice cold in the morning. And you have to go into the freezers then and lay out all the rashers and make a massive load of scrambled eggs. And but I found cutting mushrooms, you know, simple task, but I loved it. And then they asked me to do desserts then in the afternoons then for... I remember making loads of banoffees, and it was just a dead.
You cook now, well, don't you?
Now I think it's always, I guess it's another creative outlet, isn't it? In some ways. So I thought if I wasn't ever doing art, I've always have an interest in. I enjoy the process. I really, really enjoy.
We've discussed this in the past. I was talking to Gary about it. Like, I think air jobs, even though they're very, very different, there's a lot of them cross over, and I think even with musicians and, you know, that creative piece, which is a,
assembling, putting it together, getting the concepts, it's all there.
Yeah, and it can also, you know, someone that's, well, in my instance, and anyway, that creative thing also needs, there's a lot of learning around that with yourself, right? Because there's a lot of figuring out, you generally overthink things a little bit too much, and you think about the same thing all the time.
Well, generally, depending on the restaurant, like I'm in the K Club, a few different restaurants, like, but definitely for the fine dining restaurant, the Barton Room, and then, you know, the Chateau or Viewmount, over the years, I'll always draw the dish. Like, I'll sketch the dish without a doubt. And even though it's blue ink or black ink or whatever it'll be, it's the shape or the size or the dots or whatever. And I'm looking at the plate, and you can get the symmetry of the plate, really, you know, it starts to pop off a page.
Yeah.
But I draw every single plate that I ever cook.
Think about like the textures there, and the colors. It's the same thing with paint. You're looking for the textures, the volumes, how things are responding and sort of clashing in some way, how they can come. It's, I think it's all the same sort of.
And are you always happy with your work?
No way. But that's good. I'm sort of going through a moment now for the last few months to sort of really think and regroup on where I'm going, the direction I was going, and maybe I'm not really sort of feeling what I want to do. You know, the popularity, sometimes you end up just doing the same dish.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of regrouping there on that. And
well, Gareth made a comment a few weeks ago as well. If it's not broken, break it.
Break it, yeah.
And it really, really struck a chord with me. You know,
same, and I heard it. I heard someone, and that's not mine, I heard somebody else saying that, and I was like,
And
from a creative point of view.
And that's just what I'm getting off Val there when he's chatting about that. Is it going, you know, when it becomes too easy? And that was something I'd said. I was like, going, you almost feel like in our jobs, And that's what started the conversation, where I was like going, you know, if it's going for 3 or 4 weeks or a month or two and there's no drama and it's all too easy, you're like, hold on a minute here. Everybody's just coasting now and it's just a bit, we're not pushing ourselves half enough. And that's when Gareth came out with it.
Where does critique come for you? Is it outside or is it?
No, it's more internal. Yeah, you get a bit of outside. But yeah, just what you're saying there, I think are we doing that like to change it because we know that complacency can then lead to like
complacency is a disease, and, you know.
So we're always trying to recalibrate.
I think there's an element of resharpening the pencil.
Yeah, that's it.
But there's also an element of like if you do break something, it will give you a new creative and it might create something better. My biggest problem what it always is that I'm never happy with what's there, you know, and it's taken me a long time in my career to start to kind of smell the roses a bit and enjoy the success a little bit, right? And, you know, I went through a little bit of my career where I was literally wasn't happy with anything. And like, it was actually.
Life doesn't have to be a misery hole.
Yeah. Oh, no, exactly.
Yeah. It's true. And that's what it is.
No, but someone that works in the trade said it to me. Like, it was actually Ed that said it to me. He was like, Gareth, be careful, like you're not all like it's great that you're really trying to be better and you're chasing for perfection.
But things are okay.
You're chasing it. Like you ain't gonna catch it. It's great to aspire to that, but like
you look back then over a few, like I'd look back on a portfolio and to pull up an image of work and be like, oh shit, that actually was all right.
Yeah,
like,
I
brutalized that in my mind.
More often than not, you'll pull up a picture or a dish or something to come up on your phone. And I used to remember this. I remember the first menus from Viewmount House. I had this trout dish back in 2008. And it popped up on my phone around 2015 or 16. And I went, oh my goodness, the shit I was cooking. And I was just like, everybody said it was amazing. And I was there like, here I am, like with a 6 or 7 year delay of humiliation. I'm standing in my kitchen on my own. And I'm like going, oh, what must have been fucking thinking about you? It's like, look at the state of that there.
Yeah.
But at the time,
it was off its time.
It was off its time and everyone was raving about that dish. It was like a little Parisian potato. It had spinach and a beurre noisette. It was absolutely beautiful.
I remember it.
and there I was looking at it going, Jesus Christ, the state of that there. I was like, is everybody just lying to me? Like I'm a shit or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, but food, maybe like art, it just evolves at an incredible rate. Or maybe like food does art is actually my question. Does it evolve? If you're looking at your peers and guys whose style you would have maybe appreciated or admired or liked, and then your own, do you see them all going left and right of center over years, or do they stay definite to what they...
No, yeah, I think the ones that are still present or still active have to readjust and you know, sort of move with the times a bit, still being true to yourself. But then like you do have sort of in history all the masters that are there, but they sort of come from eras, like, you know, and sort of periods of time.
Art's incredible though, isn't it? Like,
I remember we were in Amsterdam when we were coming home from Australia, my wife and I, with Denise and I, and I went into the Van Gogh Museum.
Yeah.
And like at that time, like we got married out in Italy, so we were going in and out of a lot of museums, and I was only in my 20s, so I was still, you know, I thought I was cultured, but I really was only starting to really go and see things. But I remember going into the Van Gogh Museum and like being so mind blown how they displayed his art through his age. And he was doing all this Asian work, and he'd never been to Asia.
Wow.
And I was like, I still think about it. I was like, how do you know? Like, and the detail and the level of detail. And obviously, the world we're in, we focus on the details. That's where good cooks
his very starting part, but back then around that era there was a lot of artists that went, like commis chefs, you went to school and it was a trade,
a
proper trade, you got a job on it and you got supported because that's how you document the time. There's no photography, so that's how you documented lords and manners and all that sort of stuff. So there was a lot, so there really, you look at some of the artists who went more abstract, you look at their older work, they're technically like incredible artists
who
were schooled and then they went into,
because like I think when you go out when you're in Italy and it, like in the chapels in particular, And like, you're looking at the ceilings and you're like thinking somebody was lying on their back doing that. Like,
they're all doing their false course in painting, man.
Yeah, that's right. What it
was, honestly. You also went to college for art, right?
Yeah.
And like, I'm amazed that this.
You didn't do that good.
Huh?
It was a different course, or was it?
I did terrible in my leaving cert, got like 180 points or 100 something. I wasn't good in school. And then, so I do a PLC course, and that's where you do everything and you build a portfolio. And then you go to, you apply for college, so you add your portfolio points and your thing. And so I did that, and then I got into fine art in IDT, but I think I wasn't ready for it.
But can you be made better by someone actually teaching you something? Like, what are they trying to
do?
Surely great art just comes from within you.
Yeah, yeah. So again, the skill set, like last year I've been doing a part-time course in observational drawing, and that has upskilled my observation ability of like really studying something and get it.
Yeah.
But in terms of like concept belief, I don't think when I was in fine art, they could, I resisted against it because it was like I come up with a concept and the teacher, I don't believe it was true. It just didn't make sense. So no, I don't think. But I can nurture you, and you can be in an environment.
But they can help you perfect or chase.
I went and then did design, visual communications, and the tutor Dave Smith there. Do I remember all the stuff that I taught? No, but he taught me like incredible work discipline, and he was like really, really harsh, also like in a loving way. And he just was critical of my work in a good way. And because
there's indirect ways of affecting you. Because I mean, you look at us or college, or whatever. And yes, there's, you know, with a lot of chefs, like it's either internal drive really is what separates you from your peers. That's, you know, what I mean? Same. But when you're at college too, I suppose like there's lots of fundamentals that you're taught, like, you know what I mean? And there's ways of teaching. But I often wonder with an artist, and like going like, well, like how do you teach somebody that's brilliant at what they do? Like it's either a natural gift that they see depth, or they see color, or they see whatever. Like, what are you going to give that person that's going to bring more out of them? But maybe when you look at it from a constructive point of view, or as a construction point of view, maybe in that essence, it's how you're looking at it or what you're looking at.
And then all the sort of parts around it, I think it's quite similar to
you
know, being a chef and stuff.
And how long have you got the studio now?
I've had loads of different studios over the years, and I have a nicer studio now. It's on Charlemont Street.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I had the gallery part. I opened up a gallery there for sort of more emerging artists, and that was good. I closed that actually just recently. Again, just a part of the sort of revamp. I felt like this sort of cycle has stopped and starting something new. So I'm investing more time on my work and stuff like that. And still a lot of community-based projects doing like art events.
And are you disciplined in your time and approach to work? Or is it a case of every day you wake up, there's a different feeling, and there's days you could just go at something? Or do you have a fixed time where you try to say, right, no, I'm in studio today, or I'm painting today?
Yeah, because there's lots of different things. There's family, there's a lot of different components. So you have to sort of carve out the time to do it. And then you're sort of building up that, like, if I want to do a creative day or month, I'm sort of making sure I get all my ducks in a row and my kitchen clean and my tools ready. Mm. And then I can get into that flow better. Because if I just try and, it doesn't for me anyway, I can't speak, but you're not artists, I think, have to be quite regimental in how they approach things, because creativity is always there and ticking away and having a share and you're thinking you're joining the dots again and you're walking into town here and I'm joining it. But then it's action when you get into the studio or kitchen.
It's gas when you say you're cleaning your kitchen, doing whatever.
Yeah,
that's true. It's just like you've got to declutter your head completely.
Yeah. So get all the sort of admin stuff done, and then the month of October is just.
And what does it look like, Al? Like, what does a day of a creative day where you have all your ducks in a row? Like, is it fairly structured, or is it?
I try to just, in an ideal way, I get up in the morning, bit of time with family, son, maybe drop him to creche, and then I'll go to the gym if I can, or do something sort of for myself to sort of level myself out of it. And then being, optimum time for me is like 11 o'clock. If I'm in the studio at 11 and I'm ready, 11 till 4 is great. Then 4 o'clock, I'll start winding down and I'm tired, do some emails and.
Yeah.
But like everything's trying to pull you away from the studio.
Yeah.
And so it's a matter of just that discipline of like, no, don't reply to that email or don't do this, you just work on this. And then if you can get into the flow, like residencies, artist residencies are something new that I started this year. It's in Paris for the month of March and Lisbon for the month of March. And Lisbon, I went to Paris and I got on the Paris vibe, having a glass of wine every day, eating all the food. And I was taking note in the studio and my levels were down, or sort of low energy. And in Lisbon, I said, right, I'm not going to drink and I'm going to like put in, this is a time where what I think helps me is, let's say, a little bit of meditation or journaling, you know, for the head, and then a bit of training, a bit of outdoors, a bit of culture, and then creative, bit like do little bits of everything. So Lisbon, I was regimental. Every morning I got up early, did my bits, and then I got into that flow in about 4 days, and I've just notebooks have worked, like just notebooks, and it just proved that if I just am disciplined and I put those things in place.
Because there's there's a lot of distractions in Lisbon as well. It's a great city.
And there was then the goo was there every day. You know, to do it. But then I just learned that, like, if I sat with the goo for a few minutes, the goo would quieten away. And then I'd get home and I'd feel better in the morning. So it's just, now that's not all the time. But for that, I was just.
And was there
really
very clear goals before you went out there?
No, just again, back to myself. Just like, no, I just had to make 2 prints for the gallery that was there. But like, I made enough to do 20 different types of works. But it was me just testing myself, and what can I do? I wanted to also my energy and how I was feeling about myself, like personally, everything. I wasn't really where I was. So I said, how about you just like hyper focus on yourself, almost like a little retreat. And, you know, it worked out good. So,
and were you on your own or was...
I'm there for 3.5 weeks. And then my wife and son came over for the last few days because we'd done Paris together and it was deadly. But we just tried then this time, just like structure it that I'd just go and work. And it was hard, it was lonely. Like sad to leave my family for that amount of time. But I got into the rhythm of it and it was super rewarding. So
yeah, but then when you have all that time to yourself as well and no distractions, at least you got something out of it at the end.
Yeah, and again, it's trying to pull me away and stuff like that. But no joke, I was in bed for 8 o'clock nearly every evening, maybe 9. And then I was up at 6 a.m. and just like fresh. And just trying to keep motivated and utilize the time as much as I could.
Speaking of getting motivated, you just mentioned off air there before you come on, you're going baiting down the Shannon with Brezzy, are you?
Yeah, I got my saw.
I know Niall a bit, yeah. And I think they nearly looked like they bit off more than they could chew last year.
Yeah,
like those boys, I think they got a bit of a shock.
Yeah, they're good.
Going down the Shannon. And what else would you do after getting the shock? You just go back and do it again.
and add on a
cycle and a run up.
Yeah,
Carntool.
We finish the end of the Shannon, then cycle 160K to Carntool and climb Carntool. So like each day, so it's 8 days. So I've done Carntool and cycled that distance in the Ring of Kerry, but I haven't compounded after 6 days of kayak. And so it's a lot to it, but it's a good cause.
How many is going down? How many is going to do it?
I think there's it's between 9 and 12 of us. I think there's 9 who's the core group, and then let's say some people are doing a cycle.
And there's a team of people helping you. Is there like
There's a guy. There's guys that are doing it. Like Kipper is part of Canoe in Ireland. He's doing it with us, so he's sort of keeping an eye on everything.
Right.
And then there's a guy. I think his name's Howie. I haven't met him yet. He's on a boat down in front of us, and it's the lads have done it before, so they're booking up all the accommodation and just sort of figuring it out. But
no, and how many kilometers down the Shannon do you go?
I think it's
days?
3. Oh,
I was surprised.
The first day
how many days last year? Was it going, Jesus
6
Christ,
days.
Long,
yeah.
First day
is 58. Yeah. So that's about a good 10 hour a day on the kayak. Yeah. And so we're out training because it's just to train your back and my hips are sore.
Yeah.
And you know what it actually is? It's training your brain to fucking switch off, because all you want to do is get out of the kayak or
I was in a kayak last week in Loch Ree for 2.5 hours too, and your arse will be killing
whole leg's dead.
I can assure you, you'll feel nothing below your belly button after 10 hours.
So it's just the training is obviously for your body, but it's to condition your brain, I think, to just sort of get into that rhythm of distracting us. And
what was the draw? Is it the charity work there, or is it just
yes
the challenge
for sure like
it,
it's mental health awareness for it's a program that they set that they're putting into schools for free for kids,
right? Cool.
But there's another part of it too where I do sort of in some weird tear off from it. It still is a creative process. I still, like, I used to hold all my value just in my work, and that can be quite detrimental, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you're sort of saying, critique the shit out of myself. So I find different aspects of myself that I enjoy, and I enjoy these sort of, you know, it's engaging. Get to hang out with like-minded people, have new chats. Like,
I think it's part of a career progress that I'm only learning now. Like, the early part is all about learning your craft. Then you go through a part, for me in anyway, where you heavily critique it and don't enjoy it to a degree. And now I'm at a bit where I'm standing back from it going, oh yeah, look, I've done all right there. And I look back at certain parts of it. But I'm also now looking at ways to, that's why I do stuff like this, you know, like that really interests me and get myself into these conversations.
Yeah.
And find like-minded people. And
it really is.
Yeah. It's important.
We know each other from the gym.
Yeah.
It's Gar on the boxing bag. God, that's terrifying. There's that chef that I remember working with.
Pretty cranky.
Oh my God.
I hope you got a pull off him with a set of gloves on you someday.
Yeah, but you know, like, because John Belton is a
I was going to say
Kevin.
Yeah.
We were up last week. Last week we all met up for John's party and went out for a run, which is a funny. It's a very Belton thing.
It's very Belton thing. Yeah.
We met at his parents' house and we went and George and I and our friend came with us and we went for a little bit of a run. And your son was up there and you're a different stage of parenting to me, but still really cool.
Yeah. It is deadly. Yeah.
Because I can really see a different side to you, Andy, now having Alfie.
It definitely is.
What age is Alfie?
He's 2.5.
I was going to say, I have a 3-year-old too, yes.
Yeah.
I was going to say,
it changes things up.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
You know, for the better, like, and like, this definitely, I've found it stressful at times, like, you know, trying to juggle everything and work for yourself. But all in all, it's a nice new chapter for sure.
And it's lovely to go home to that after a good day too, when you graft out in particular, you know what I mean? And then you go home to your girl and the wee dude and good times, you know,
isn't it?
How often do you release prints, Al? Are you still doing that?
I do different parts. I'd have exhibitions, I'd do paintings, then prints, and I'd sort of do maybe some commercial projects as well. So really when I'm in the mood, when I go, that I think that would translate as a print, I'd usually do a painting. Or like, the reason I was in Lisbon, because I was working with a print gallery there, fine art print gallery, so there's screen printing and old school sort of printing, and I'll release stuff with them next month now.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Proudly sponsored by John Stone Beef. Explore delicious recipes and discover their premium selection on johnstonebeef.com.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Proudly sponsored by John Stone Beef, a tradition of Irish dry-aged beef built on 60 years of passion. Learn more at johnstonebeef.com.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
So for the snooty chef here now, right?
Yeah.
And educate me. I look at prints maybe completely wrong. I'm like going, like, if I can't buy the art, I don't want to buy the print.
Mm.
Is that stupid? Or is that commonplace?
No, so you might be thinking of just like a replica print of a painting.
Yeah.
There's tiers to it then as well. So there's like a limited edition print, which might be made with hand screen printed and they're numbered in editions.
Yes.
So that sort of gives it its value, let's say. So it's a tiered approach, really. The original painting being, let's say, 10 grand to, let's say, a poster, which is 100 quid. And then you got like fine art prints that are really big, that might cost 3 grand, then to 2, then to 500. So it's a collector's sort of thing. And it's a nice way as well for, well, collectors who like prints. I enjoy them. But then also, maybe you're new to collecting and want to start collecting artworks. And I see collectors I have over the years to work the way up.
Because Gormley's at the minute, like, I'm the executive chef of the K Club. And for the next month, we've got the art and sculpture displays going on. I think there must be north of 9-10 million worth of work on the ground for the K Club at the minute. There's Andy Warhol's there. Loads of Irish artists, but some of the sculptures on the grounds.
You shared one yesterday, a bit like a teddy bear.
Absolutely. They're unbelievable. So they are.
Some
of the artists.
Size of them.
And like, I mean, there's actually a few.
See them actually bring them in then. There's proper cranes.
It's forklifts and cranes. They were nearly.
What I find anyway with art, like, from if you're looking at something and it's making you think, then that for me is good art.
Yeah.
You know, like, and if it's a poster, it's a poster. If it's a painting, it's a painting. And
yeah.
Like, I was there yesterday with the Rose of Tralee girls. They were doing a promo thing.
Right? You were going to get that in.
You had one of those things.
he was standing in between 20 of Lane crackers.
32 of them, actually.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
And I was there and somebody said, oh, what is that clock thing down there? And I looked down, like, the pathway valley. and the lawns of the cake were out the back. And I was like, well, I don't know how much that is, but the wee tiny version of it is in there and it's 25 grand. Wow. And she just went, all right, I'll keep on moving. So, but I was like, it's just incredible, like, the stuff that's there, you know? And yeah. I suppose, like, having your stuff chosen for a showcase like that must be... I mean, because most of it's been bought already. Like, there was a dude walking around like, well, I'll take that. Yeah. There was, if you had the beans, I don't know where you would stop because it's just the most incredible stuff. But what's unbelievable is, what is art to all these different artists? When you have, let's think of any good gallery, but when you're there now and you walk from the Rococo Hall into the Tara Suite, into the Henry Lounge and the grounds of the Cake Club, you've got all these different paintings and you're just like, Jesus, like all the different styles, all the different ways of doing it. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Asian cuisine, Japanese cuisine, Middle Eastern
all
cuisine.
All the different dishes.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
You know,
and it's,
but it's the thing about, it's like food, you know, it's subjective. What you and I like is
that's it. Like,
very different.
Well, I go to Lisbon, let's say, and I go to the Contemporary Museum, and 80% of it I probably don't engage with it. I don't really respond to it. And as you say, I just go and look at it, and if I gravitate towards it, I want to then learn more.
Well, the Louvre is a perfect example. I mean, everything starts to look the same after about 20 minutes.
And that's it as well. You have to sort of manage, like, you can't go in and try and see it all and try and appreciate it. That's just like your belly's full and still hoovering food into you. Like, you can't appreciate it.
I remember seeing the statue of David in the Albert when I was in Florence, I think. And in my mind, I thought I was going to see this little statue. I don't know why I thought that, but I didn't think. And I walked into this, and here I'm looking up at this, and I was like, it blew my mind how big. And then there was these cool iPads where you could look at the levels of detail on its arm, and made like every vein. And you're like, when you think back then,
I know.
When there was not a whole lot, it was a hammer and a chisel, I'm assuming, right? And
I don't know the exact techniques. Like,
yeah, but I'm just but like, it's meant.
And like, you just chip it wrong and it's done.
It's done, yeah. Right when you get to the fingers.
Yeah.
A little wonky fingers.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
it's unbelievable. Yeah, but it's, yeah. I mean, I went through Rome one day and I remember saying to Annette, my wife, going like, Jesus Christ, every second building would be a national monument in Ireland.
Right,
like,
yeah.
Paris.
Just
Paris
incredible.
Does the same to you. It just blows your mind. You're like,
yeah, it's really
Jesus, incredible. Like, well, just calm down, lads. Like, every other building, it's breathtaking.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Now, I don't know much about history, but I'm presuming it's something to do back in the day where they were really, really rich empires and they were...
Yeah.
All those monuments around...
I don't know.
All those gold monuments around Paris, I know, it was a show of wealth that you can see on the water. And, you know, whoever it was that was in charge at the time was just spending the money on that, like, you know. So.
Yeah, nice.
So it's really interesting. Yeah. Well, there's someone like you that was riding that wave. I'll make another one of them.
Yeah, I'll do another go. Okay. No problem.
Yeah.
Well, we do our last supper.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so it's a wee thing that we do, Al.
Yeah.
You've a half an hour left on this earth. What are you eating? What's the last supper look like for you?
Oh, God, I don't know. Like, give me more of a context.
It's your last supper. It's your last thing. It's your last dinner. Clock out. What's the one thing that really brings you joy? It can be a start, a main course, dessert. It can be... We've had quite... I'll give you some of the answers we've had. We've had, like...
Kebabs. 9-course tasting menus.
Nevin McGuire gave us a 9-course tasting menu. The last lads that were in, they gave us chicken wings as a starter, and one of them gave us a burger as a main.
That's right.
What do you want to chow down on? Burgers are always good as a starter. Yeah.
Every man.
But like, I'm jumping to shepherd's pie because I'm dying.
Comfort. Yeah, that's it.
And is it illegal to say brown sauce?
No, you're a brown sauce man.
Meet your brother. You can't eat a shepherd's pie without brown.
I did it 2 days ago, man. It was chef. Like, I just put a
has to be chef brown sauce.
Yes,
Heinz for red. Chef for brown.
Yeah, you could do that. Like, I'm not too pushy on the brown sauce because I could go whatever.
Whatever's yeah. there, once it's brown.
But like, yeah, shepherd's pie is cool. And I actually really enjoy making shepherd's pie.
I'm going to make a shepherd's pie tonight.
Yeah. There's something comfort in it, like, you know, and you hoover it.
Yeah.
You, oh, yeah. you put it in a bush. And
oh, yeah. You just yeah. tear into it. It's just a constant shovel.
Yeah.
Of no fork and knife, just the fork, only one movement.
Yeah. No much thinking.
You hit a spot with it there.
You just gotta do the windmill,
and
you know?
If you get a good shepherd's pie when you're out, like, I wouldn't probably order it that much because it's hitting.
You don't see it too often. No. Stevie used to do a fancy one in the Pig's Ear in Dublin. Used to do, like, I have a fancy one actually in a restaurant in Paris. I'm finished there now, but it was a slow cooked shoulder, and then I had little brunoise of celery and carrot and a lovely rich veal stock, and then I'd cook down the lamb shoulder in that stock. Lamb stock's a bit too strong, so I'd use a bit of both, and you'd the mirepoix of veg, and then obviously like a little buttered truffled mashed potato finished with Parmesan on top.
No brown sauce for that sitting.
You don't need the brown sauce. I might frown upon you.
Yeah,
but
no,
if nobody was watching, I'd be sticking in a wee bit of brown sauce.
That's always, I always love the idea of a carvery, but I'm always disappointed. I think I never hit a carvery well. I can't. What would you recommend for a carvery?
Carvery's deadly after a hangover. Annette laughs at me. I just say I'm going for a feed of spuds.
Yeah.
You know what? There's not enough places.
Nowhere. Carvery. It's hard to find a place that does carvery now, isn't it?
The Goy Bay Hotel in Salt Hill does a carvery still, I think, at lunchtime. Yeah, you go there. They used to have a lot
Searson's
of people.
Searson's on, what's that, Bagger Street? They do one. It's
most bars used to do a carvery.
I don't think anymore. The gastro bar kind of moved the carvery out, like, you know.
Yeah.
It's all chicken Caesar wraps and paninis now. What a load of nonsense.
But also as well, like, it's a la carte cooking, so there's much less waste. And
yeah.
You know, the footfall isn't there for lunch anymore. That's the other thing. If you're roasting up a joint of turkey and beef and ham or whatever else, and then no one comes in, like, there's a lot of waste there. So
that's what
I think happened.
Yeah,
that's what goes on.
But there you are, shepherd's pie. Do you know what? If this show goes on long enough, we're in our fourth season now. We're gonna get a death row cookbook out of it.
Yeah, exactly.
It'll be deadly.
It'll be diverse.
It'll be very diverse.
The fourth season, we had a lot of people were saying that steak, and you know, but since then it's turned the corner.
Yeah. The key is not to tell anybody coming on that they're getting.
It has to be football.
Because then you come too armed. You're far better to come from the heart. You know what I mean? And say like, feed a shepherd's pie.
I'm definitely
making a shepherd's pie.
But even that I like the ritual of making that now. I'm saying mine's very basic to yours, but like the prep and that, like, and assembling it all together, I enjoy that.
Do you find you're cooking at home a bit more now with the little fella? More of an effort.
No, it's better now because we bought a house and it was like a tiny little, it's just very small house, tiny little kitchen and then living room. But so I made sure to knock down that wall and put an island there. It's
only because it's a pain in the hole to bring a 2.5-year-old to a restaurant. It's a nightmare.
What am I doing?
We did it with Cora. Like, I have a daughter and two sons, and she's 10 now. But I remember we went to John to Time in Athlone. Cora's an angel. It's her first time in a restaurant. I swear to God, the starters landed at the table, and the sweetest girl in the world
turned into
a fucking devil. And Annette and I looked at each other, and I went. And we gave up. We got as far as the main course, whatever. We just looked at it. And I just said, Annette, this is a friend's restaurant. And goes, we are out. Now, we were the first ones in, but then other people started arriving.
Yeah.
And I just started thinking of other customers. And John says, that's it. I pulled my own family out of the restaurant. I said, that's it. You're going home. You're done. You're out. And Cora was never brought back to another restaurant. And she ruined it for my two sons. I was like, she's a smart one and she's whatever. I goes, there's no way you boys will behave, you know what I mean? Yeah, she's 10 now. She's brilliant now, you know, but at 2.5, we just went a bit too early thinking that we were great parents, but no, the devil came out along with the starters and that was the end of that move, you know. We moved on swiftly. Well, listen, Al, it was a pleasure to meet
you. Yeah, pleasure.
Thanks for coming in, Al. I really appreciate it.
No bother.
Thanks for your time. Busy, man.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, that was good crack with Al, wasn't it? I told you he was going to be an interesting cat.
Yeah, lovely guy, found that brilliant to talk to.
Yeah, and it's like his career is so vast. I mean, he's painted all over the world nearly now at this stage, you know? Yeah. So, and he was a new daddy, only, I think Alfie's just gone one, so...
Yeah.
Yeah, really good guy.
Saying, yeah, I must get my hands on one of his pieces.
Yeah, well, I tell you, get ready to dig deep.
Yeah, get in early.
He does
print. That's the key.
Yeah, exactly. He does prints as well. So keep an eye on his Instagram and stuff for his release dates.
So, guys, I think it's your turn this week for the ingredients. I went with a fancy pantsy burger last week.
Sure did. And I gave that recipe a go for the red onion.
Yeah, you said you were going to chance it.
So delicious.
You like it?
It's the Worcestershire, I think, is the thing that brings it all together.
The Worcestershire.
Yeah, easy for you to say. It's one of those ingredients I never put in recipes because I don't like saying it out loud.
Worcester.
Yeah. It's deadly gear.
So you have a few choices. Ribeye roast, fillet head, which I think you already dabbled in. Cote de Boeuf, beef dripping tub, the steak burgers, which I've already used up, and those jumbo sausages, you know.
Well, what I'm going to go with is the beef dripping, because I'd say if anybody's ordered this box and they got that little tub of beef dripping, they're probably wondering, what could I ever do with that? And really, there's loads of things that you can do with it. And I think the most obvious thing to do with it is to do roast potatoes in there.
Yeah.
So like at Christmas time, maybe you've tried the goose fat roasted potatoes. So you're going to do the same thing. So you're going to get a nice roasting potato, give it a peel, wash it in some cold water, and then dry it off really well. Sorry, wash it all off, and then you're going to parboil them. So what do I mean by that? Bring it up, put your potatoes in some cold salted water, bring it up to a boil, and cook them for about 5 minutes, and then strain them off. And when you strain them off, leave them for a couple of minutes and give them a good shake in the colander. And what that does is it kind of breaks the outer part of them up a little bit. While all that's going on, I want you to put a heavy roasting tray into the oven and put 2 good tablespoons of that beef dripping into the roasting tray and put your oven on at 220 degrees. Then with your potatoes, put them back into the pot for a minute on the heat, and you're just going to dry them off. I think you call it team, and you leave call me a word, yeah. So you basically put your potatoes back into a pot onto a medium to high heat, and you just burn off any air, you evaporate off.
Give them a wee bounce off the
edges. Just give them, and you want them to kind of break up a little bit. They're not smash up, but you just want them to look like
that
floury.
It helps with the crispiness, the flouriness, yeah.
Exactly. And then all you're going to do is carefully open your oven door, and from the pan, there's no water in there now, you're just going to pour that into the hot beef dripping, and you're going to roast them for about 45 to 50 minutes. Some chefs season them at the start. I don't. I like to season my roast potatoes in the last 5 or 10 minutes because I find when you season them at the start, it tends to extract a bit of moisture and they don't go as crispy. And then if you want to, like 10 minutes before the end, if you wanted to put a handful of rosemary sprigs on there or some thyme or some crushed garlic, would be delicious. It's probably the best thing, I would say. If you bought a little bit more of the beef dripping, you could fill a fat fryer and you could do beef dripping.
Well, I was going to say, growing up, we only ever cooked chips and dripping lard. Yeah, like you'd buy the blocks of beef lard or whatever and beef dripping.
Do you know what else they're amazing for is if you're making Yorkshire pudding.
Yorkshire puddings.
So maybe we'll do that on another show. If you just if you make a Yorkshire pudding recipe and instead of putting vegetable oil into your Yorkshire pudding tray, use the beef dripping. So really, really delicious product. And yeah, look, give it a go.
Sounds good.
So next up, we've got the part of the show where we hear from you. So it's our culinary conundrum. So Ed Chef, over to you.
Right, lads, we're going from Belfast to Dublin to Sligo this week for conundrums. Starting off in Belfast, I desperately need your help in spicing up my life. Oh, I want to create more complex flavors in my dishes without making them too spicy. How can I use spices like cumin, coriander and cardamom? Cardamom, yeah, effectively. And could you recommend a specific recipe where these shine? Many thanks. Love the pod. Charlene Robinson in Belfast.
I mean, the obvious, as soon as you said those three spices, the one that sprung to my mind was butter chicken, that wonderful masala dish, which is really easy to make. All you need is, you need plenty of onions, garlic and ginger, which are going to fry down in some vegetable oil or in some clarified butter or ghee, as it's called in the Indian cookery. And then you're going to add in those spices. So you've got 1 heaped teaspoon of cumin, then a couple of coriander, and then I like to split the cardamom pods and just take the black cardamom out. So the way you do that is you just roast them in a dry pan a little bit and then you put them into a mortar and pestle and just give it a gentle tap of the mortar. And then you can see these little black pods fall out, pop them in. And then you'd also want to get some smoked paprika in there and a little bit of chili powder. Cook that out a little bit more for about like 10 or 15 minutes. Then you're going to go in with some freshly chopped tomato, if you want a tin of chopped tomatoes. blitz that sauce up with a little small hand blender, and then you finish the sauce with a splash of cream and some knobs of butter, just whisk it into the sauce, and then you put some marinated chicken breast that you marinate in some yogurt and the same spices that I told you, and then lay that marinated chicken out onto a tray, roast it in the oven at 250 degrees, so as hot as your oven goes, and let it caramelize, and then you put that roasted chicken into that buttery spiced sauce. And like, I suppose there's two things to think about when you think about spice: heat, so like harissa and, you know, cayenne pepper and chili powder and all the jalapeno and all those other types. And then the other, the wonderful part of spice is that background heat. So you're not talking about actually the burny part of it. It's like the spice part of it. And that's where I think the magic lies.
Yeah,
the
there's a lot of aromatic spices.
Exactly, that's
as
the word
well.
I was looking
for. Yeah, aromatic spices as opposed to, like, and that's sort of the Middle Eastern spices, like the cumins and the coriander and the likes of those, fenugreek, like they're aromatic as opposed to the chilies and all the paste.
And just buy small amounts. That's the other thing I would say to you is, like, don't buy big tubs of spices. Mm. Buy them in small amounts. Try and use them as often as you can. And I think I've said it on here before, but if you've got an Asian supermarket or an ethnic supermarket close to your house, that's where you should be buying your spices.
And buy them whole as often as you can, like, because then you just dry pan roast, and you actually completely replenish them. Powdered spice, isn't that after 2-3 months, are actually obsolete anyway. And
really?
The thing is people are using them like a year later in their house. But if you're using cardamom pods, like he mentioned, and you throw in a bit of cinnamon and you've got other bits of dried, you know, ancho chilies and this, that and the other, and you dry pan roast them then into the mortar and pestle and you grind them down, they're absolutely brand spanking new when you treat them like that. The difference will be in the smell in the room, and that's how you tell. It's night and day.
Great stuff. Thank you, Charlene, up in Belfast. Best of luck with that. How are you, Gareth and Gary? Not so much a conundrum. This is a great question, actually, for you both. But I just wanted to ask, what was the most disastrous experience you had in the kitchen over the years? And on the flip side, what is the one you look back on as your greatest triumph? Cheers, Barry Fallon in Dublin. Gary, what do you think of that? The one that keeps you up, you know, you wake up sweating in the middle of the night.
Well, when I was quite young, Mr. Casey in the Rosapenna, he used to have this knack of calling the fridge a freezer or the freezer a fridge or whatever it was. And he came rolling through. I only saw him last week. I stayed up in the Rosapenna, actually. He was my first ever boss. And we used to get all this wild salmon. And now wild salmon is expensive. It was expensive back in the 90s whenever I was cooking. And Mr. Casey used to go into the larder every night right before dinner, and he used to cut the salmon for the hotel. He used to cut the smoked salmon that we'd smoke, and then he would take off all the sides of beef that we had, our own aging chambers and aging rooms in the hotel, which a lot of hotels would have had back then. And he would go into the butcher's block. So I'd often go downstairs, and I'd be the commis chef at the time, and I was helping him. So he'd be carrying in like all the strip loins and sirloins. And anyway, he turned around one day and he said, Gary, he goes, put this in the freezer. But I knew he meant the fridge, because he always referred to the fridge as the freezer. But I put it in the fridge like an idiot. And it was nearly a grand's worth of salmon, you know.
Ooh.
But the next day he had this walk, right, that when he came up, like, his heel absolutely planted into the ground. And I was in the pot corner washing pots. And pots in the Rosapenna, you were also responsible for the veg and the potato for the hotel. So I was prepping veg and washing pots. And next thing that you could feel the fucking ground vibrating, right? And I thought, holy shit, that's Mr. Casey coming looking for me. And I have a fucking...
It's like Jurassic Park.
I can actually feel the feeling I had that day in 1993. I'm feeling it right now.
Yeah.
I could feel him coming down the corridor. Where's the salmon? And the second I heard where's the salmon, part of my soul left my body. And it's never come back. And I was like, oh, it's in the freezer where you told me to put them. And I went, he meant the fridge. And he went clean mental. Yeah, and I just was like, oh, you stupid bollocks. Like, it's always the fridge. It's always... Yeah. And I knew that. I knew it, you know what I mean? But I don't think I've ever made any drastic, costly mistake like that since. And it wasn't. I actually did what I was told, but I should have known better, like, because I knew...
Yeah, well, you didn't ruin it. It just needed to be defrosted. Obviously, you needed it for something.
Yeah, yeah. It had already been in
there. I see the pain in his eyes now still.
Oh, it was already frozen.
Yeah, it had already been in there.
Oh,
yeah.
That's it.
So you didn't
it was
ruin
ruined.
It.
Yeah, it was all over.
Ooh, moving swiftly.
It was all over.
I feel like stamping my heels on the ground now after hearing that.
Gareth, what about you?
Just, I find that one hard to follow. I remember when I started cooking that, like, you know, overcooking steaks and over-seasoning sauces, and it's part of learning, right? But at the time, I used to like, beat myself up a bit over it, you know? And
or can he beat you up?
Yeah, well, like, you know, exactly. But, like, cooking on it, you start off in the starter section. Like, we've spoken about, you know, how it works, but generally speaking, you start off in the garmanger or the starters, and then you make your way over onto the garnish section. And, like, the ingredients generally are cheaper on these sections. And then when you're really starting to come into your own, you make your way onto the sauce section or the grilled section. So you're handling holdover soles and fillets of beef and chateaubriands and ribeyes, and, you know, it's part of cooking. You overcook things from time to time, which means you have to cook them again. So, like, but I really used to give myself a hard time over that, you know, and that's probably a measure of showing that you care, right? But, you know, now when I see young chefs overcooking things, you know, like, I try and explain to them that it's part of it. You have to just learn from it, and the most important thing is that you're honest. You know, because when you're on the pass and you say, how long is it going to be for that fillet steak? And 9 times out of 10, if they've overcooked it, they know they've overcooked it and they don't tell you. And
they're
then
too
it
scared.
Well, whenever you get a mumble.
Yeah, yeah. And you're like, give me a look at it. And you're like, you just have a squeeze of it and go, get another one cooking. So, you know, they're not major. At the time, I thought these were major, you know, catastrophes.
It's like any craft. If you're a chippy, you know, you've got the cuts on your thumbs to prove.
Yeah, exactly.
And what about your triumphs? Is there any moments you look back on?
Gary and I cooked a dinner a few years ago for the RAIs, and I cooked the main course at it. It was a, you know,
1,300 chefs and restaurants. It's the Restaurant of the Year Awards. We've cooked that dinner together a few times.
Yeah, and Gary, I got in and helped him with his course, and he got in and helped me with mine, and that was like trying to cook 1,300 steaks medium rare for all your peers. And, you know, after that, there's a lot of people saying to you, like, how did you do it and how did you cook that many steaks? And really, it was the team of people that work.
But the lovely part about that dinner is, to be cooking the dinner, you got to be in the top 5 chefs in the country the previous year. So the best chef Dublin, the best Ulster, Munster, Leinster, Connacht.
Yeah.
And your gift is to come back and cook. Your gift is to come back and cook a dinner for everybody in the business worth talking about the following year. But that was one of the best days of my career too.
It was a great day. We had real, real good fun.
Must have been some buzz afterwards.
Well, that was the first day Gareth and I ever cooked together. And the only time we ever cooked together, it was awesome,
Need to rattle the pans again soon, guys.
Yeah, and I've...
But things like that you think about. I mean, like, there's loads of times, you know, I do these wine dinners in the hotel. I do 3 or 4 of them a year. And I really enjoy doing them. You know, I really enjoy, you know, creating these menus that go alongside wine. You know, there's loads of things in my career that I enjoy, but, you know, big events like that are definitely up there.
Yeah, no, they are.
Brilliant. And finally, Frank in Sligo. Since I gave up the gargle 3 months ago, I've been putting all the energy that I used to have into the kitchen. I've saved a few bob. I want to make a bit of an investment, but there are so many kitchen gadgets available these days. If I were to invest in just one high quality tool for improving my cooking, what would you recommend and why? I have about €600 to play with. Thanks a million, Frank.
I would say a good stand mixer. Like, if you were to get your hands on a really nice Kenwood Chef or a KitchenAid, depending on, you know, what you want. Like, go into Arnott's. Go downstairs in Arnott's. It's absolutely a mecca for a cook.
You've or said that before,
a home cook or a chef. And, you know, from cakes, baking, from breads, lots of those mixers as well, like the Kenwoods and that, and I'm sure the KitchenAids are the same. They come with machines, like attachments and add-ons. They've got a mincer, you can make your own mince. There's sausage makers that come with them, so you're making sausages and then you push it through, because the PTO that's in the motor, like, there's a little cool thing that attaches on, and it just like in a tractor, you have a PTO that turns all the machines that spread stuff in fields. All those mixers also have a PTO, like you take off a wee cap and they're all nice and subtle and the attachments go on. They've got pasta rollers, pasta machines.
Swiss Army knife of cooking. It's got everything.
The Kenwood Chef is absolutely unbelievable in particular, you know what I mean? Because as I say, like I've got the pasta rollers and then you've got all the cutters. So you'll take out the roller, then you'll add in the attachment, whether it's fettuccine, tagliatelle or spaghetti. Yeah, so you make fresh pasta, you roll it through the machine and then you actually cut it on the machine. The burger press or the mince press, you're making your own mince. They're absolutely unbelievable. And then the actual machine itself, you know, you making anything from sticky toffee puddings to cakes to bakes to focaccia bread to white bread to batch loaves, pizza doughs, you name it. Absolutely one of the most utilizable pieces of kit. $400, $500, $600 will get you the top of the line.
Fantastic.
In that.
There's your answer, Frank, and best of luck with that. And thanks to everyone for sending in your conundrums into Dishy. Now keep them coming in. food@goloudnow.com.
So that's another episode done and dusted, Gary. So good one again today.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah, good chat with Al. Nice guy.
Sound as a pound, Jay. Yeah.
Questions coming in are getting better and better too.
They are. It's great to hear so much coming in, isn't it? People are really dialing into the show, which is great. So also I'd like to just thank our sponsor, Premium Irish Dry Aged Beef, John Stone. So visit them at www.johnstonebeef.com. Home deliveries available. Give them a shout and we'll talk to you next week.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Proudly sponsored by John Stone Fine Foods. Get premium Irish dry-aged beef delivered to your home at johnstonebeef.com.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.